Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life.
Hey, y'all. Happy 2 days after St. Patrick's Day, Matt and Ben.
Happy two Thanks. Days after St. Patrick's Day. That's kind of a mouthful.
Two it days is, after but you're St. still Patrick's wearing Day. Green. You're still wearing green.
I do have my green, listener, you can't see me, obviously, but I do have my green plaid, mostly because it's cold today. We're recording this on the Monday after St. Patrick's Day. So anyway, it's cold. This is a warm shirt.
I just asked you if you wore green, you know, on St. Patrick's Day, and you said you wore one little green necklace.
I had a green necklace on. Well, you know, I had a green necklace on because my wife brought me one from
home.
And
probably also because you have to, like, you know, help balance out Matt, because Matt, you dress up like a lot.
Look, like a leprechaun is what I thought you were going to say, and that is exactly what Matt looked like. A leprechaun.
Matt, help us know what you wore on St. Patrick's Day.
I wore a green pair of shoes with gold and shamrocks on them, a pair of orange pants. I wore a gold fanny pack with a rainbow strap around my waist and rainbow suspenders. Of course, my clergy shirt. I did not wear a necklace because I wear a cross on Sundays, right? Like a good Christian, Ben. And then I had a little green top hat, a green little hat.
Listeners, you need to look on social media for a picture. It's something. It's something to behold.
I feel like there are 2 days a year.
Okay.
There's 2 days a year where adults get to dress up and have fun. Really.
And this is one of them?
St. Patrick's Day is one. Think about it. And then Halloween is the other. That's it. Now, some people do it like on the 4th of July, you know, right, but that's a little different. It's a little different. I just feel like there's 2 days a year where adults can cosplay. And the only people that give them shade are their friends they podcast with. And that's it. Everybody else enjoys it. Now, I will say this. I will say, so Ben is right. I dressed up. He didn't really. The necklace that Deb brought, listener, were Mardi Gras beads. So Ben was wearing green Mardi Gras beads. Right? Well, and I don't know.
It was a green necklace. Sure. They might have been Mardi Gras beads. I don't know.
I think they were Mardi Gras beads.
But they were green, so it's appropriate.
Yeah.
Even though it's the middle of Lent.
Listen,
I think it's a testimony. It's a testimony to the sanctification of our church that no one asked Ben to flash them, I think.
Oh, my goodness.
Wearing those Mardi Gras beads, you were taking a gamble, Ben.
You think so?
You were gambling. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Big time, okay. Buddy.
Listen, I wore a green sweater and I gave my kids Lucky Charms. That's what we did for St. Patrick's Day.
Very nice.
And read our little St. Patrick's Day book. That's about what we did. It was great.
That is nice. I like that.
You look like you're in an elevator. Are you in an elevator? You're not at home.
No.
Where are you?
This is a surprise I said I had for you. I'm at my co-working space because even though I looked at my schedule 3 times this morning, I left the house totally forgetting that we had podcast intros. So I'm in this little soundproof little room here.
Okay.
It does kind of look like an elevator.
It does. It's about the same size. Anyway. Yes, glad you're with us, even though, you know, listener, you'll notice that Matt's voice sounds a little different than it normally does. So, I will say that something fun that we did on St. Patrick's Day was our neighborhood that we moved into recently has like 6 events every year that are like neighborhood wide, you know, kind of like let's all get together, and we do a porch crawl. We did a porch crawl. It was really cold, but there's like dozens of people came out. for this porch crawl where we just go to like four different porches and people have little drinks and snacks.
That's cool.
And then we're all decorated for St. Patrick's Day. It was really nice.
Got
to know a lot of my neighbors and meet their dogs and things like that. So it was a lovely time. We hung out for like 4 hours.
Wow!
Like just traveling from house to house. It was exhausting for me as an introvert after church to go and just chat people up for 4 hours. I was ready for bed about 6 p.m. on Sunday night. So.
Oh, that's fun. That's really fun.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah. So.
Well, today we have Ryan
Stoller. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he talks about child liberation. Yeah. We actually had a dinner conversation because, you know, we were talking about it. We had some guests over and I was saying that we had recorded this and they're like, what's child liberation? I'm like, you should listen to the podcast. Like it's explained. It's great. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. This is exciting. I think he's a child advocate, Ryan is, and this interview is just scratching the surface of the work his book does, which I think is reading the scriptures, paying attention to kids and paying attention to how kids would hear and read scripture. And I think in the, 2024, when we're becoming more and more aware of helping kids ask for what they need, notice that they have some agency over their body, say when things aren't good for them, right? Set boundaries, those kinds of things, that it's even more important that we become a little more conversant with the ways in which kids can hear scripture and how sometimes scripture can be really triggering or frightening for children, you know?
So, yeah, I'm actually teaching, preaching on Abraham and Isaac in a couple of weeks. And like child liberation theology is important when we think about this and how am I communicating and who's in the audience and all of that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's something that was just never on my radar, but like now that I think about it, right. After, thinking about this and doing this interview, like what a terrifying story for a child to hear, right? Abraham and Isaac is sort of like, oh my gosh, like God said what?
Yes.
You know, what almost happened?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it could be terrifying for children. So anyway, it's fascinating to think of children as a marginalized people group is a fascinating lens through which to see those little guys. So anyway.
Yeah. All right.
All right. Well, let's get into it.
All right. Yeah.
Ryan Stoller joins us today on the Gravity Podcast. He's a child liberation theologian and an advocate for children and abuse survivors. He holds an MHS in child protection from Nova Southeastern University and an MA in Eastern Classics from St. John's College. Today, we're chatting about his new book, The Kingdom of Children, A Liberation Theology. Ryan, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. Great to be here.
Yeah. Well, we like to start out by getting context for people's interests. You know, the things that I tend to write about intersect with my personal life. So a lot of times my writing is working out my life and lives of other people that I've met. So would you share a bit about how you became interested in children and in particular, the work you're doing in this book?
Absolutely. I will try to reduce a long story into a small amount of time. I was raised and homeschooled by conservative evangelical parents from kindergarten all the way through high school graduation. So I grew up in a very conservative fundamentalist community. And while my homeschooling experience was generally positive, I did have a lot of friends who did not have good experiences. They experienced abuse and neglect in their homes and communities. And so when I became an adult, I started an organization called Homeschoolers Anonymous, and it was a platform for my friends and peers to share their experiences about what it was like growing up being homeschooled. And as I was involved in that organization and helping my peers and advocating for them, I decided that I needed to be better equipped to do that work. So I went back to school and got a master's in child protection. And while getting that master's, I was constantly being confronted with this problem, which was that so much of what I grew up with in terms of how people should be interacting with children and treating children and how they believe that children should be raised and disciplined was in diametric opposition to what I was learning was the best practices for child development and child rearing in my program. And so this raised the question for me of, you know, is there a better way of viewing God and the Bible and Jesus and how that relates to children? Could we think about those things in a way that is actually empowering for children rather than what I was raised with, which was, you know, those God and the Bible being used to control children or to force children into the molds that adults want them to be. So my mind immediately went to liberation theology, because when I was in college, a friend had introduced me to liberation theology, and I really was drawn to it. I really appreciated how liberation theology emphasizes how our faith needs to be something that makes a actual difference in how we live our day-to-day lives. And so I wanted to think about, you know, could we use liberation theology to change how we use God and the Bible and Jesus so that that can be equipping and empowering children to live, you know, better and more liberated lives.
I want to dive into liberation theology in just a second, but I'm curious if, like, this book is unique in the way that most books kind of for children fall into two categories. Either it's about kids or it's for kids, but this is different. And maybe you would call this a book from kids. Can you help our listeners? Like, how would you categorize it? How would you describe this book?
I would describe this book as an attempt to do both, to bring both of those ideas together. I think that for me, child liberation theology involves two parts. One, the first part is about adults. It is a challenge to us as adults to rethink God and the Bible and to think about how we have created barriers for children to not be able to access and participate fully in their faith communities. So kind of the first stage of child liberation theology is adults actually deconstructing those barriers and making our homes and faith communities and organizations accessible to children so that children can actually be a part of them. And then the second stage of child liberation theology is actually getting children involved in the process themselves. I think that children have not only the ability to participate in their communities, but they also have the right to do that. And so the second stage of child liberation theology is actually, you know, turning the theology over to children so that they can do with it what they would like to, and so that they can actually be meaningful participants in their own liberation. So my book is really an attempt to bring those two things together so that adults and children can be equal participants in the process.
We'll be right back.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course,
our 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn how to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life that God shares with us. It is a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying out some new practices. In the Gravity Formation course, we go below the surface of our lives so that we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence and to discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us toward holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people from all over the world in this formation framework, and it's helped many people to have a sense of God at work in their lives and learn to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
Let's get back to the show.
You know, when I've heard stories about people who are homeschooled, I typically think of them in two categories. One is, you know, had a great experience. You know, my parents were great and, you know, being homeschooled was fine and good. And I learned a lot of cool stuff that I maybe couldn't have learned, you know, in public school or whatever. And then the other version of the stories though, is usually like, yeah, it was weird, you know, but mm-hmm. I like you're opening us up to this world where it's like, oh, and also oftentimes it's downright abusive, actually. It, you know, if we can use that word for it. Mm-hmm. I just think that using the lens of liberation theology to talk about this issue of, you know, children and the relationship that parents have with their children, especially those of us coming out of the evangelical world, where I do think there is a sense in which what we're taught is that, you know, if you raise your kids right, you know, there you can basically kind of control the outcome of their lives. And that ends up being, you know, kind of applied in very sometimes benevolent ways, but it opens the door for very abusive kinds of situations as well. So I wonder if we can double click, as Christy mentioned, maybe double click on this. Maybe some of our listeners are not familiar with liberation theology and how that works, or what does that lens mean when you apply it to children? You know, and why did you choose that lens, and what's compelling about that for you? I don't know if you can just double click on that, open it up, unpack it a bit for us.
Yeah, definitely. Liberation theology is a very diverse field. It was something that originated from American Black theologians. The first liberation theologian was mm-hmm. James Cone, who wrote Black Theology and Black Power. And he was a American theologian who wrote starting in the 1960s. And then around the exact same time, there was a priest in Peru, Gustavo Gutierrez, who wrote A Theology of Liberation. And these two individuals are kind of like the founding individuals of the field of liberation theology. And they both wrote in very different contexts, but they also shared a lot in common. And since they wrote, liberation theology has taken off, and it's essentially something that can be taken on and applied to any marginalized group of people that you could think of. So there's now there's a liberation theology for you know, for women. There's liberation theology for queer people. There's liberation theology for you know, different races, different ethnicities, even nationalities. There's a Korean liberation theology, and each of these theologies, they are very context-driven and unique. So, you know, while they share some things in common with each other, which is why they're all, you know, quote-unquote liberation theologies, they also take different forms because each of the groups that they belong to are unique and have unique needs and wants. So there was not, interestingly, when I was started writing about this, much of an emphasis on applying liberation theology to children. So when I first got interested in this thing, this subject, I, you know, researched it and to see if, you know, who was writing about how we can apply liberation ideas to children. And there was literally only one book. It was called Suffer the Children, written by a woman named Janet Pice in 1991. So a very long time ago. And that was literally the only book that had explored how we could apply liberation theology specifically to children. So,
yeah.
Well, I think that it's a very important application and a very important exercise to think about how we could do this. There was not really a lot of prior work or information that I could build upon. So I had to really reach and dig deep into the other liberation theologies to guide me as I wrote the book and engaged in the work.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think, Ryan, the tradition I come out of is much more in touch with the danger of idolizing kids or creating a life that orbits around the kids' activities and schedules and potential, right? So that they aren't caught up into something greater than themselves. And so I'm just noticing in me that, yeah, it's a little bit of a surprise that we would need some kind of liberative theology of kids. But I think that you're right on. I want to pivot maybe to the first part of your book. You talk about reading the Bible with kids, both good stories and bad stories. And I'm going to ask you in a second to tell us to pick one of those, and I'll maybe throw out one, and you can tell us the story, how to read a bad story through kids' eyes. But I remember early on in my ministry, I was standing in the children's ministry wing at my church, and a friend of mine who wasn't on staff pointed up to the border along the top of the kids' ministry wall, which we can all picture it in our minds. There's just animals, right, from Noah's Ark. And my friend pointed to it, and he said, "You ever thought that we decorate our kids' ministry rooms in the story from the Bible where God kills every single living thing except for one family and all but two of each kind of animal?" And I was like, "No." No, they're just cute animals, right? But I think it was the first time I realized, like, man, there's a lot of stories in the Bible that just aren't kid friendly. You know, you're not going to read them the story of Lot and his daughters, or Noah and his daughters, or, you know, all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So I wonder, you handle like one of those stories, the Binding of Isaac, and you talk about Lot's daughters, and you talk about, oh yeah, you talk about the group of kids that pick on Elijah. You know, could you pick one of those stories and walk us through like what loving children looks like as we read these stories? Just pick one of them and maybe kind of walk us through what that looks like.
Can I actually request that you pick Isaac, because I'm preaching on that in a couple weeks and I'm going to need some help.
Certainly. I do think it's both fascinating and disturbing that we decorate our children's nurseries with these images of a story about ultimately genocide. I think that's fascinating. I think that we just make this association with like animals, and children love animals, and so we think there's so many animals in the story that it has to be child friendly, but it's really not. And I think that actually illustrates for me this problem and opportunity of what I describe as the Bible's unseen children, because even in the story of Noah's flood, you know, there are no children directly mentioned, but we know children had to be there, because anytime you have adults, you have children. That's just, you know, it's like the chicken and egg problem. So if there were adults around that were killed because of the flood, then there had to have been children too. And so even in stories that don't directly mention or involve children in the Bible, I think that it's a very important exercise to always be asking ourselves, you know, are there actually children here that are not seen, that really are here, that are impacted by the words and actions of the characters that we do hear about. So I'll let that, I'll transition from that to the story of the Binding of Isaac. And I think that for me, you know, reading the Bible, especially these stories that are involve, you know, abuse or some other way in which children are harmed, I think we need to be asking ourselves how we can read the story in a way that edifies us in our current context. I think these stories are often read, especially for those of us who grew up evangelical, if, you know, the story involves someone that we think in general is a good character, we assume all their actions are good instead of just interpreting their actions as, you know, is this actually helpful to children or harmful to children? And so when we look at the story of Abraham and Isaac, where Abraham takes Isaac up the mountain to sacrifice him, you know, I think the first thing that we need to be concerned about is paying attention to the actual child in the story, because in this story, we do have direct references to Isaac being there. And I think most of the time we think about the story of Abraham and Isaac, our concerns are about Abraham. So we don't pay a lot of attention to Isaac and how he experienced it. So most of the times we do reflect on the story. We're wondering, you know, did Abraham do the right thing? Did Abraham pass the test or not? Is Abraham a model for faith? And what goes completely unexplored is Isaac and how he experienced the events in question and his faith and how he experienced the test. I think it's interesting that when we read the story in the Tanakh, the Jewish scriptures, Abraham and Isaac are in conversation on the way up the mountain. Isaac asks him where the sacrifice will come from, and Abraham says, God will provide. He does not disclose to Isaac what God had actually in the text required of him, which is sacrificing Isaac. So in the text itself, Abraham is not entirely truthful. But what's notable to me in that exchange is that Isaac is actually vocal. And then after they get to the mountain and after Abraham ties him up and raises the knife, on the way back down, the text specifically says that Abraham descended the mountain, and it does not mention Isaac again. So there's not, it seems like they're a team going up, and then on the way back down, they're not. So for me, that's an indication that something was disrupted in the relationship. And I think that it's interesting that I mentioned this in my book, that in the Quran, the text actually has Abraham and Isaac discuss together what God had required of Abraham. And so in the Quran, there is more of a sense of Isaac actually having agency and being aware of what's going on and actually being able to make a decision on his own about whether he wants to go forward or not. So when I read the version in the Tanakh and see the disruption that happens, I find that meaningful. And I think it's also interesting that Abraham and Isaac do not have any more interactions after that specific moment in the text. So for me, that seems to like indicate that, well, the story may or may not be a story about Abraham's faith. There's also something more important going on, which is the actual relationship between a parent and his child. And regardless of whether Abraham had extreme faith or not, I think that, you know, faith has value only insofar as it is in the context of our relationships with one another. And this is something that liberation theology is always trying to emphasize, which is that our faith is always lived out in relation to other people. It's very contextual. It's very relationally driven. And so if we are practicing our faith in a way that is causing, you know, disruptions to our relationships because we're harming one another, then that's when our faith is no longer serving a holy purpose. It's become something else.
Yeah, you wonder, like, if that is the pinnacle of the rest of Abraham's family being jacked up. I mean, they needed a lot of money for counseling back then, and they didn't have any. And so you just, like, you just see example after example after example after that story of just how messed up Abraham's family and generations to come are.
And now, a word from a sponsor. All right, let's get back into our conversation.
Gosh, I want to pivot here to the part of your, the beginning of your book about why you wrote the book. And I'm just going to read some statistics that you wrote, and then I want to return to this story. You wrote, a report of child abuse is made every 10 seconds in the United States. Globally, one in three victims of human trafficking is a kid. The U.S. is one of the worst child abuse records among industrialized nations, losing on average 5 children every day to child abuse and neglect. The U.S. also incarcerates more of its children than any country in the world. 34% of LGBTQIA youth suffer physical violence from their parents because of their sexual orientation. Suicide has become the second leading cause of death among teenagers in the U.S. And then last one here. 67% of all sexual abuse reported to law enforcement in the U.S. each year is perpetuated against children. 1 in 4 girls, 1 in 6 boys are sexually abused before the age of 18. Now, I want to return to this Abraham text, and I'm just thinking about if I'm a 1 in 4 or 1 in 6, and I'm listening to this story, like how triggering it would be to listen to a God telling an adult to kill a child if I've been abused. You know, and that's not even, I mean, it could be triggering for all of us because, you know, we're like, wait, is that really God? Would Jesus do that? You know, like that's, those things happened for all of us. But I think your reading of the text, close reading, where Isaac comes down alone, is the kind of theology that is all over the place in like Jewish Midrash and things like that, where they take a verse, they notice something about Isaac being alone. And then they wonder, sort of, and they do an inspired wondering about why was he alone? Where was Isaac? What was Isaac doing? Here's the narrative of Isaac and why he wasn't there. And I think that as Christians, we've been taught that that's like adding to the text or maybe not faithful to the text. But I just want to say, like, I wonder if we can learn from our Jewish brothers and sisters that kind of theology, especially because of our 1 in 4 and 1 in 6 cultural moment, maybe the most faithful thing we can do. And I wonder if I could get your response on that, Ryan, if I'm listening to you in the way that you hope this book stirs us to.
Definitely. I think that especially for those of us who grew up evangelical, we were taught to read the text in a very flattened and reductionist sense. And much of my book actually is a reflection on my interaction with Jewish interpretations of these stories. And I find it very meaningful personally and very healing, honestly, to engage biblical texts in a way that really wrestles with them and doesn't just blithely accept them at face value. And that is something that I did learn directly from Jewish people. I think that in the Jewish tradition, there's much more, as you were saying, this emphasis on really trying to understand the different nuances of the story and trying to engage them as active participants in that process. I mention in the book, for example, that I think that it's really important that we approach the text like how Jacob wrestled with God. I think that the story of Jacob wrestling with God is a very powerful and meaningful story that is can be seen as like a model for how we engage texts. I don't think that we have to just always accept that, you know, the people that we think are either good and holy are always going to be perfect. Like, you know, Abraham being the model for faith doesn't, like, should not be taken to mean that Abraham is the model for faith when he trafficked his wife sexually.
Yeah.
Or when any of the patriarchs in the Jewish scriptures took on like slaves as sexual partners. You know, there's in evangelicalism, we often read those stories as we try to figure out some way to creatively justify them instead of just actually the more easy and honest way, which is just to assume, okay, if we know that that's wrong, then that should just be considered wrong, even, you know, several thousand years ago. So we should be, I think this whole process of like deconstructing the text, you know, instead of actually being something that's new and postmodern, it's actually something that's very old. And I think a very faithful way to read the Bible. And definitely for me, that's inspired from reading some of the ways that Jewish people approach these texts. Like with the story of Abraham and Isaac, for a lot of Jewish people, Abraham actually failed the test. For Jewish people, God would never require a human or child sacrifice. And so the fact that Abraham actually was going to do it is for them a signal that he either didn't understand or was too zealous in his faith, such that he misunderstood or did something that God actually found detestable. And then the same way, like the story you mentioned earlier, that I discussed the story of Elisha and the children who mock him and his baldness, and he sicks the bears on them. Like for Jewish people, that's a sign that Elisha failed his test from God. He acted out of anger instead of out of kindness to young people. Whereas evangelicals read that story and they're like, well, Elisha was good, so therefore everything Elisha did had to have been good too. And so therefore the children must in some sense be in the wrong.
Right. So parents, or so kids, you know, don't disrespect adults.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. Like that's the message, right?
Or God will send bears to eat.
Yeah. You never know what's going to happen.
So, yeah, I mean, just this willingness to say maybe actually those people were wrong in those moments.
Right.
It's not actually a huge shift, really. It's a pretty simple thing to do. But it does really challenge this evangelical worldview in which you have to read the Bible in this only one way, or else you are going to lose your faith and go to hell.
Yeah. Yes. When you put it that starkly, right? I think that's true, though. I think that's the instinct. And I still feel that as I read the scriptures. I still feel like, oh, I've got to figure out why Abraham sacrificing his son is a good thing. And I got to figure, and that's a complicated one, obviously, just because of the way that some of the New Testament writers talk about that being an expression of Abraham's faith and all that kind of thing. But I guess just the realization that like people can be exemplars of faith and also make terrible decisions and fail in many, many ways. It actually is maybe, it makes our heroes of the faith a bit more relatable, maybe, to be like, oh, that's like me. You know, like some days I feel full of faith and I make, you know, I really do believe the gospel and I believe what God says to me. And other days I really fail miserably and I'm part of God's story too.
Yeah.
I would like to ask you about how you end each chapter with this kind of an including children section. That's it's intended to bring kids and adults together to shape child liberation. And so I wonder if, you know, for those of us who are used to sort of this one way adult to child direction, where it's like, if I'm the adult, then I'm teaching my children or directing them or telling them what to do or telling them how they're going to be experiencing child liberation. You know, for those of us who are maybe used to that way of faith and faith formation, maybe help us gain an imagination for how this sort of a more mutual and generative approach can be really fruitful for faith formation as we think about what it might mean, especially for maybe parents with kids at home still, young kids, you know, help us gain an imagination for how we could be more mutual and generative with our kids in faith formation and child liberation.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think that, you know, having a posture of openness towards children and what they can contribute to our own lives and our own thinking is very important in that regard. I think that, you know, in terms of imagination, we often think that, you know, children need to simply be learners and recipients of adult knowledge. And that, you know, that can be everywhere from Sunday school to normal school. I mean, I think that the way that we educate and teach children in normal school and Sunday school is often the same, which is that we see education as this process of adults depositing knowledge into children's minds. And while I think that adults have a lot to offer children, the problem with that model is that it's only one way. It's not assuming that children also have so much to, you know, so much knowledge and wisdom to offer adults as well. And so I think that, you know, creating homes and faith communities and schools where we see children as being active agents in their own learning is really critical. And so I think one way that parents can do that, really anyone can do that, is, you know, is asking children what they think about things. I think that's the just the simple three words, like, what do you think? No, the four words, what do you think? That's like a power phrase that really opens up some space for children to realize that they have the right and the ability to have their own thoughts. That's going to be really key. Like, whether it's, you know, obviously there's big ways we can do that. Like, when we're asking children, you know, what do they think about, you know, God and the Bible and Jesus, and what do they think about their own faith and how they interpret different biblical stories. But also just even in the small things, like asking children what they want to wear for the day, what they want to eat for dinner next week, what do they think about how their school day went. You know, just giving children the space to be able to have those thoughts is really the first step, honestly. A lot of times when people think about children being participants or leaders in their communities, they don't really have a framework for that because the children around them don't seem to have those. And that's not because children don't have them. It's because we haven't given them the permission to express them. And so they don't have the opportunity or even the daily practice of having their own thoughts or their feelings and expressing them. And so just giving them that space to know that it's okay to have those things is really important for them to be able to develop into being participants and leaders and the bigger things. You know, starting with giving them permission to, you know, decide on food or dress is how you start small and scaffold up to the bigger questions of, you know, hey, do you want to go to public school or do you want to go be homeschooled? Like, what are you feeling about how you know the church you're going to? What are you feeling about school? Like, all these much bigger questions for children to have the skills to answer them. You have to start with the smaller ones.
Yeah,
that's great.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah, there's. I'm dealing with this right now with my 15-year-old. He's asking me tons of questions about current events, right? This election coming up in 2024. And I find this tension between wanting to hear what he thinks, asking him good questions, and just sort of being like, look, dude, here's what you need to think. you know, because it's so clear to me. Ryan, we could talk to you all day about this. You've got a wonderful section on encountering God as a child. And I think I'll forever look at the nativity scenes differently because of that chapter. And there's so many other rich pieces here. We'll let our listeners read through that as they are able to get the book. But maybe as we close here, where can people find out more about you and your advocacy work if they want to know more?
My website is R.L. Stoller. Last name is STOLLAR.com. So rlstoller.com. And then I am also on Twitter at rlstoller. I have tons of free writings on my website about child liberation theology. I also have a lot of information about evangelical homeschooling and what it was like growing up in those communities. So if folks are interested in either subject, there's tons of resources on my website that they can read there.
Great. The book again is The Kingdom of Children, A Liberation Theology. Ryan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It was great to be here.
You know, we didn't really talk about this, but as he was talking, I was thinking about just the ways that children, that God works in and through children in our lives. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think there's not a big focus on that, but just a few weeks ago, I was at winter camp with 661 high school kids. Y'all, wow. It was a lot of people.
Okay. Jeez. Yeah.
Anyway, the speaker was talking and basically talking about reconciliation and asking everybody, like, where is a place where you maybe don't believe that God could bring reconciliation? And to think about that and to kind of confess that and ask God to meet you in that. And so I'm like praying and I thought of a situation and I was like trying to justify not having reconciliation in that relationship. And I was like, Lord, is that, and I was praying like, Lord, can you just help me really know if this is a place where deep, real, authentic reconciliation can really happen? And as I'm praying, this student comes up to me and I'm thinking, oh, here's my chance. Like I'm a family and student pastor. Like it's my chance to be Pastor Christie, you know? And so I bend down and I'm like, hey, sweetheart, like, what do you want to share? And the girl looks at me and she's like, I don't have anything to share with you, but do you have something you want to share with me? And I, like, it was a moment that for sure God working through this student. And like, I didn't give her the details of my situation. I did explain, like, this is what I was thinking about. And I started crying and she started crying because it was an act of obedience to Holy Spirit to come and say that to me. And that, and I just thought, I think we discard kids, like God working in and through kids the way that he does.
Yes.
And that to me is just like, as Ryan was talking, I was thinking about that situation and so grateful for that girl's courage and bravery and obedience to come and to talk to me because it, cause God used it in my life.
Yeah. That's great. Christy, I love that story. I love exploring this idea, I guess, of kind of using, of learning to look through the lens of, you know, liberation theology towards children. There's just so many assumptions, I think, especially those of us who grew up in the evangelical kind of world, there's so many assumptions we have about the family and how, you know, like homeschooling is automatically good because the family is good, you know, it's God ordained and it's, you know, kids should be with their parents and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But this, all during this interview, I had this, I don't know the quote specifically, but I think it's from Emily McGowan, who wrote about kind of the homeschooling movement and is a friend of ours. But it's something like the thing that we don't often realize is that families can be the most dangerous place for children. Like they are completely, like if you've got, they are completely, children are
completely at the whim of their parents. I mean, beside, you know, obviously in like overtly abusive cases, you know, we talk about child protective services, the state gets involved, you know, all of that kind of thing. But there's a whole gray area there where like children are just so marginalized within families. And that, I don't know, it's just not often that I think, oh yeah, a family could be a very dangerous place for a child.
Yep.
That is just sobering for me to think about it that way.
It is sobering. It's like we don't often think about that. I don't think we often... It's hard to keep that in focus because of the emotional mm-hmm. and mental and spiritual anguish it produces. Mm-hmm. Right, Christy? We've talked about suicide before and how it's so hard to talk about suicide before it happens, because to do it, you have to marshal some resiliency to the anguish of facing the fact that it's the second leading cause of death among teenagers.
Right.
Which is horrifying, right? So yeah. I think we'd rather just exhale and have good vibes. And I think that, you know, one of the gifts that Ryan does is helps us bring our attention back. And this is like a project I'm on 10 years now of building the resiliency to tell the truth about the world in the hope of Jesus mm-hmm. Christ. And take care of myself as I do it, so that I don't have to choose between two of those things, mm-hmm. right? I really want to develop the kind of resiliency and character to be able to maintain telling the truth about reality, yeah. you know? And I appreciate Ryan doing that here today for us. So yep. Just to pat myself on the back a bit, Christy, I was going to tell you a joke to end this podcast.
And you're not. About, look at you.
About tofu, and I decided not to because it was tasteless.
Oh my gosh!
So everybody,
he's working hard at finding ways to surprise you, Christy.
Yes, he is. I was actually going to be really proud of him. Now I'm not.
I don't know what you're talking about. No. I'm just no jokes.
Just saying that I didn't tell the joke. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, there you have it, folks. Mm-hmm. Enjoy your day.
See you. See you next time. Peace.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity community. It's free to join, and you can connect with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith, spirituality, and whatever else comes up. Also, Ben and I hang out there a lot. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsternke.com. And we'd love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, go to gravitycommons.com/message and click the Start Recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.